Again, today is January 17th of 1993. It was almost 12 years ago that the U.S. hostages that were taken prisoner at the United States Embassy on November 4th, 1979, were released, and this was coupled with the inaugural proceedings for Ronald Reagan and created a truly festive mood for Ronald Reagan to take office. There are substantive indications from a number of sources that, in fact, there was a deal cut between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to deliberately withhold the hostages taken from the United States Embassy until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. Congressional investigations, very tepid and inadequate, have poo-pooed the notion that such an October surprise, as it has been termed, took place, but in fact there are substantive indications that just such a deal was cut. I would note that, as is the case with all investigations into the national security establishment and the intelligence community in particular, there has been plenty of disinformation generated about the October surprise. There also, as is the case with regard to investigations of the intelligence community and the national security establishment, there are areas that have yet to be properly investigated. There are areas where one cannot say whether or not the information is valid or invalid. There are areas where deliberate disinformation has been disseminated by the intelligence community, and there are also areas where misinformation or disinformation has been generated by sincere but misguided elements. This has been one of the problems when investigating the intelligence community. The intelligence community does not advertise its activities, and they don't wear badges. Nonetheless, official denials to the contrary notwithstanding, there are substantive indications that, in fact, the October surprise did occur. What I'm going to read now is a circular letter that was generated and disseminated by an Iranian researcher living in the United States, who in turn is affiliated with elements of the anti-Khomeini or anti-fundamentalist resistance. This gentleman's name is Farah Mansour, F-A-R-A-M-A-N-S-O-O-R. He's currently based in Southern California. I was hoping to interview him this evening, but I was unable to contact him in time. I have spoken with him both in person and on the phone a number of times. I've seen some of the documentation upon which his research is based, in addition to sources in Iran. And again, Farah Mansour is affiliated with elements of the Iranian resistance. Farah and his colleagues have drawn on information that they obtained from the United States archives as a result of Freedom of Information Act suits. I would note that Farah and his colleagues have been threatened both by some of the players in the Iran-Contra scandal, such as colleagues of, at least according to Farah, unnamed colleagues of Albert Hakim threatened him. And I would also note that he and the colleagues have been threatened by people in Iran as well, where they've been threatened with death and violence to their families if they were to disclose what they had learned. Again, I want to emphasize that the information contained in the circuit, or some of it, a fair amount of it, dovetails with information that has long been available from one source or another. I've seen some of the documentation upon which some of it was based, and some of it is based on information that I cannot vouch for. So I want to reiterate that particular caveat with regard to this piece of research. And again, this is not to impugn Farah or his colleagues or their work, but simply from my standpoint, I cannot vouch for a fair amount of what's in here. This is not to impugn its integrity, but rather to suggest that, as I say so often, this is food for thought and grounds for further research. Some of the information has been on the public record for a long time. Some of it I know checks out. Some of it I cannot speak for, but I think it is thought-provoking and needs to be looked into by serious investigators. This particular circular was entitled by Farah and his colleagues, and once again I want to reiterate that I'm going to be interviewing Farah when the circumstances permit in the not-too-distant future. This particular circular was headlined or entitled by Farah, "Crucial Information About the 1979 Iranian Hostage Crisis Ignored by the Major News Media." And this four-page circular reads as follows. By the way, I'm reading this by way of observing the Reagan and Bush administrations leaving power, and it has been roughly 12 years since the hostages came home. "For 13 years, the truth behind the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis has been buried in a landfill of disinformation. However, new research has finally unveiled the enigma. Weaving itself through the, quote, chaos, unquote, was an historic covert operation engineered by the Agents for Bush covert team in an alliance with the Islamic fundamentalists. That, quote, drama, unquote, was purposed to consolidate Khomeini's power in Iran and put Bush in the White House. The contention by Farah and his colleagues is that the October surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan and Bush campaign, was not only not the most important part, but was merely an outgrowth of a much broader U.S. policy involving active CIA support for the Islamic fundamentalist forces in Iran, and that this policy is ongoing, and that this policy has implications far beyond either the October surprise or the Iran-Contra scandal per se. And again, I'm reading this by way of observing the Reagan and Bush administration's termination, and by way of noting that the forces that they represent, and Reagan and Bush were merely tools of more powerful forces, these forces are very much with us, they are still in power, and any would-be Democrat with a small D in the White House or elsewhere will ultimately have to contend successfully with these very powerful forces if any of the political ideals that most of us believe in are to be successfully realized. It is the contention of Farah Mansour and his colleagues that, in fact, the U.S. support for the Islamic fundamentalists, of which the October surprise was an outgrowth, began in the mid-1970s when the CIA learned that the Shah of Iran, a U.S. protege, had contracted cancer, and that this ultimately obviously meant that he would be leaving power. It is the contention of Farah and his colleagues that, in fact, the alliance between the CIA and George Bush and the Islamic fundamentalists began in the 70s, and that when a hostile Carter administration came into power, this already established and ongoing alliance was utilized to destabilize the Carter administration as well as to continue an anti-Soviet government in Iran. The Shah, of course, was fiercely anti-Soviet, and as indicated by Farah, or as maintained by Farah and his colleagues, the CIA and George Bush actively allied themselves and supported the Islamic fundamentalist movement in order to continue to see to it that there would be a continuity of anti-communism on the part of Iran in the Middle East. Farah and colleagues go on to say, Iran has long been the keystone of U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East. The Shah was put there to maintain stability. However, in 1975, Richard Helms, I would interject at that time director of the CIA, 1975 Richard Helms was not director of the CIA, he was U.S. ambassador to Iran. William Colby was director of the CIA, however, Helms was former CIA director. However, in 1975, Richard Helms learned that the Shah had cancer. Under George Bush, the CIA used this exclusive knowledge to quietly prepare for the Shah's departure. That last sentence again, because it's a fitting, it's important as we watch George Bush leaving office. Under George Bush, the CIA used this exclusive knowledge to quietly prepare for the Shah's departure. Knowing nothing about this, President Carter instituted policies that split the intelligence community and alienated that faction of it fiercely loyal to George Bush. While Carter blindly pursued human rights, the Bush faction pursued its own private foreign policy to keep Iran intact and communist free. To that end, it privately allied itself with the Islamic fundamentalists of Khomeini. That alliance promoted the Islamic Republic of Iran and engineered the hostage crisis. That so-called crisis was a political management tool used to consolidate Khomeini's control of Iran and pave the way for George Bush to gain the White House by destabilizing President Carter. 1. The Shah of Iran was diagnosed with cancer in 1974. 2. In 1975, former CIA director and U.S. Ambassador Richard Helms, a close personal friend of the Shah and an associate of George Bush, learned the secret of the Shah's cancer. On November 4, 1976, soon after the results of the presidential election in favor of Jimmy Carter were known, the CIA under George Bush anticipated the premature transition of power in Iran from the Shah to his successor. See Note A, and I'm going to read that in a minute. Agents for Bush covert team chose the Islamic fundamentalists as the best available alternative to keep Iran intact and communist-free. One of the things we're going to touch on next week is a portion of an article from Covert Action Information Bulletin issue number 33 entitled Agents for Bush, dealing with the very significant support inside of the intelligence community for the candidacy of George Bush in 1980 when he was challenging Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination. Note A, alluded to in that passage by Farah and his colleagues, reads as follows. Documents indicate that CIA Director George Bush had known of the Shah's cancer by late 1976, if not earlier. A secret memo from the Director of Central Intelligence dated November 4, 1976, asked, quote, "Have there been any changes in the personality patterns of the Shah? What are their implications for political behavior? Identification of top military officers that most likely play key roles in any transference of power if the Shah were killed," unquote. Another memo on November 4, 1976 stated, quote, "Not only do we need future reflection on what is behind the Shah's words and action, but also additional information and field analysis is needed as to how decisions are formed and who is influential in implementing them. It is particularly important to know what subjects are withheld from the Shah and the degree to which reports to him are doctored by his subordinates. To what extent do such practices warp his perspectives, isolate him, and peril his regime? They, people at the agency, do not have adequate information and field analysis regarding his succession to the throne. What are the mechanics? Who will be the leading actors? How will the Shah's pet projects, including the economic development program, be affected by his departure?" Unquote. Again, this document obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, obviously anticipating the Shah's fall. This from November 4th of 1976. George Bush was director of the CIA and aware at this point that Jimmy Carter would be taking over. The next section of this particular circular letter reads as follows. However, Carter's presidency split the CIA, alienating the pro-Bush covert team, most of whom Carter had fired. Recall, Jimmy Carter conducted a house cleaning of sorts of the CIA, and many long-term agency employees and officials, including many of the ones who later cropped up in various aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, were dismissed at that point. The letter goes on. In response to Carter's lack of, quote, cooperativeness, unquote, the pro-Bush covert team then fomented the Islamic Revolution and piggybacked it onto the existing popular revolt against the Shah. This last sentence again, because it places the allegations set forth here by Farah and his colleagues, place the October surprise in a much broader context, and they maintain that that deal was not only real, but one outgrowth of a much broader policy involving active CIA support for the Islamic fundamentalist movement in Iran, again tabbing them as the designated anti-communist successors to the Shah. The sentence reads, in response to Carter's lack of cooperativeness in quotes, the pro-Bush covert team then fomented the Islamic Revolution and piggybacked it onto the existing popular revolt against the Shah. By the end of April 1978, private citizens George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher were in Iran. A confidential minutes of U.S. Embassy country team meeting under direction of then-U.S. Ambassador William Sullivan, dated April 26, 1976, is noted, quote, "The ambassador commented on our distinguished visitors, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Margaret Thatcher, and commented that Tehran seems to be the site for an opposition party's Congress," unquote. Again, this particular piece of research, this allegation by Farah and his colleagues, maintains that George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher were in Iran in April of 1978, and they quote, and again they obtained documentation on this, they quote minutes of a U.S. Embassy country team as follows, quote, "The ambassador commented on our distinguished visitors, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and Margaret Thatcher, and commented that Tehran seems to be the site for an opposition party's Congress," unquote. The next paragraph reads, "In early October of 1978, the agents for Bush covert team brought Khomeini back to Iran from a 14-year exile in Iraq, stopping off in Paris, France for a four-month Western media blitz. On February 14, 1979, 2 weeks after Khomeini's return to Iran, the U.S. Embassy in Tehran was seized by Khomeini supporters disguised as leftist guerrillas in an attempt to neutralize the left. U.S. hostages were seized, but to the chagrin of Khomeini's fundamentalists, the Iranian coalition government restored order immediately." Recall, this was the pre-Khomeini and post-Shah government of Shapur Bakhtiar. However, that same day, Khomeini's aides supplied the embassy with a team of Iranians for compound security. Ambassador Sullivan installed, armed and trained this, quote, SWAT squad, unquote, led by SAVAK/CIA agent Mashallah Kashani. That man's name, MashallahKashani. This particular paragraph generated this information, this allegation by Farah and his colleagues maintains that in February of 79, 2 weeks after Khomeini was shipped back to Iran by the CIA and Bush allied forces, there was an abortive takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran. It was conducted by Khomeini supporters disguised as leftists, and although the coalition government in Iran restored order, Khomeini's aides supplied the embassy with a team of Iranians for compound security, and that they were led, and again, this is a pro-Khomeini team, by a SAVAK CIA agent named Mashallah Kashani. Again, I want to emphasize that I cannot vouch for many of the allegations that are contained in this circular letter. Some of them, many of them, agree with information or dovetail with information generated from other sources for a long time. I've seen the documentation for some of this, but again, I want to offer the caveat that I cannot vouch for a good deal of what is said. This is in no way to cast aspersions on it, but rather to encourage responsible investigators to begin looking into this potentially devastating information. The next paragraph proceeds, or the next paragraph of this letter, pro-Bush CIA official George Kay visited Iran from August through October 31st, 1979, to provide intelligence briefings to Khomeini's aides. With all the Iranian officials who had restored order in the first embassy seizure eliminated, the stage was set for what happened next. And again, it's the contention of Farah and his colleagues in the resistance that the February 14th abortive seizure of the U.S. embassy set the stage for the successful seizure in November of 79, and that people put into the embassy for security, Iranians, were in fact working not only for the Khomeini forces, but for the CIA and SAVAK, the SAVAK Shah's brutal secret police. This paragraph goes on to say, see, quote, decoded, unquote, classified cable, see note B, disclosing the role of Warren Christopher in these events. And the second footnote to that paragraph, quote, also see the, quote, decoded, unquote, classified cable, see note C, indicating George Cave's, quote, mission, unquote. Again, the reason I'm going into this circular letter and the allegations contained in it is that the National Security Establishment and the forces that brought Reagan and Bush to power have not disappeared. The National Security Establishment is not a monolith. There are elements that support the activities described here, elements that are opposed to it. But with Warren Christopher being the Secretary of State designate, there are indications that, in fact, it would be business as usual at Foggy Bottom, as the State Department is known, and that at least according to the information presented here, Warren Christopher may have been complicit in the events surrounding October's surprise. Note A, provided in the circular letter, reads, documents indicate that CIA Director George Bush had known of the Shah's cancer by late 1976, if not earlier. A secret memo from the Director of Central Intelligence, dated November 4, 1976, asked, quote, have there been any changes in the personality patterns of the Shah? What are their implications? Oh, that's note 8. I've already read that. Excuse me. On note B, on August 2, 1979, Henry Precht, P-R-E-C-H-T, director of the Iran desk at the State Department, sent a cable to the U.S. Embassy team Tehran and the subject briefing, 1, secret, entire text, 2, briefing officer Robert Clayton Ames, A-M-E-S, will arrive on Air Force 168, August 21st at 10 p.m. from Paris. He will have a courier letter in order to protect briefing materials in his possession. Ames' passport number 135101, issued June 1st, 1978 in Washington. Please meet and assist. And the third subhead to this paragraph, if feasible, suggested you contact rehearsal of briefing with Ames before going to meeting with Iranians. Christopher, that of course refers to a Secretary of State designate Christopher. Say that's Bill Clinton's incoming Secretary of State. And note C alluded to here reads, and there are two extracts here. Note C, on October 21st, the CIA official stationed in Tehran alerted his counterpart in Paris that the Shah's imminent arrival in the U.S. would make certain difficulties. Quote, since reference B have learned that Amir Entezam, A-M-I-R-E-N-T-E-Z-A-M, took part in meeting which charge and Mr. Henry Precht had with Premier Bazargan and Foreign Minister Yazdi, Y-A-Z-D-I, to pass message on Shah stays health and imminent arrival in the United States. Amir Entazam's reaction was that this development would make more difficult efforts of those who have been trying to improve relations with the United States. Since Amir Entazam, fully apprised of R.N. parentheses Shah outstays plans, it may not be necessary to advise him that Mr. Cave has important intelligence for him. Please advise whether HQ still wants station to alert Entazam that Mr. Cave wants to meet him in Europe as possible. I suspect that's supposed to be as early as possible, 21st October, all secret, unquote. Note, Amir Entazam was Iran's deputy prime minister, later Iranian ambassador to Sweden. I would also note that in telephonic communication with Farah Mansour, Mansour maintains that this past week, the individual referred to, former foreign minister Yazdi, was in the United States for a conference at Columbia University on democracy and Islam. And the next section of Note C reads, a CIA cable dated October 31st, 1979, from Tehran to its headquarters reveals the sensitivity of George Cave's 11th-hour, quote, mission, unquote, to Iran. Quote, proposed extension of George Cave's visit raises questions of his safety and of Amir Entazam's expressed concern about, quote, manipulation of the revolution. Knowing no more than we do here about it, his tours must defer to him and HQs, that's CIA HQs, for consideration of personal security implication of a series of operational contacts. Regarding possible political fallout, we think there are substantial risks involved and the chargé, Bruce Langan, advises that he is concerned. We assume that Cave's prolonged presence could not be concealed from the Iranians, those unaware of his secret mission on behalf of the, quote, alliance, unquote, and that no innocuous pretext, such as tourism, would be credible. At least some of his proposed contacts would therefore presumably have to be declared to, quote, Entazam and company, Bazargan, unquote, the cable concluded. And the last section of Note C reads, quote, in order to permit evaluation of risks and benefits of these contacts, request CIA headquarters identify them for us and indicate which of them would be declared, unquote. And going on with the rest of the last paragraph of this particular circular letter, on November 4th, 1979, the U.S. Embassy was taken again. Leading the charge was none other than Ambassador Sullivan's, quote, trusty butcher, unquote, Mashallah Kashani, custodian of embassy security from February through August of 1979. And again, I want to reiterate that a fair amount of this information can be corroborated from other sources. Some of it's been on the public record for a long time. Some of it I dealt with in the miscellaneous, or not the miscellaneous, but in the seven-part and ongoing Radio Free America series dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. I've seen some of the documentation obtained by foreign colleagues. Some of it I cannot verify independently, and that's not to cast aspersions on the information here, but rather to suggest that responsible researchers and journalists pursue it, because the implications of these allegations, should they pan out, are enormous. And again, the fundamentals of this circular letter being that was generated by Farah Mansour and colleagues in the anti-fundamentalist Iranian resistance is that the October surprise, as we have come to note it, the apparent deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran was not only real, but that it, in and of itself, it was a relatively minor outgrowth of a broader policy of CIA support for the Islamic fundamentalist forces in Iran to ensure that an anti-communist anti-US faction would come to power there. For all of the anti-American rhetoric generated by the fundamentalist forces in Iran, in fact, as the Iran-Contra scandal later disclosed, the Reagan and Bush administrations were in bed with those very forces. And again, I want to emphasize, I want to remind members of the listening audience that in weeks to come, I hope to interview Farah Mansour and gain more insight into the allegations in this letter that's circulated by he and his colleagues.
That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.
Tonight's broadcast will be going into the archives as not only another installment begun last week of Radio Free America program number 38, The Terror Connection Part 3, Realizing the Fourth Reich, but many of the sections of tonight's broadcast will also go into the archives as addenda to other archive programs. By the way, people who are interested in getting a hold of some of the documentation for some of the lines of argument I present here, contact Archives on Audio, and you may want to get a hold of the catalog, too, which lists all of the archive shows, cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material, and gives a synoptic account of each one of the archive shows. Several weeks ago, in fact 2 weeks ago, on this station, I rebroadcast Radio Free America program number 32. Radio Free America program 32 was the fourth Radio Free America series in a eight-part and ongoing series dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. I entitled that particular broadcast, The Terror Connection Part 3, Staging the Fourth Reich. We are going to talk about the Terror Connection Part 4, I should call, RFA 38, Staging or Realizing the Fourth Reich. This will be the eighth archive show dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal, but in reality, we will be dealing with far more than the Iran-Contra scandal per se, just as we will be dealing with far more than just terrorism per se. One of the main thrusts of this particular program, this archive show, will be to demonstrate how counterterrorism was used as a rationalization for creating a number of apparatuses within the national security establishment for completely circumventing the democratic process. Oliver North and his abuses under the Iran-Contra scandal was utilizing these apparatuses, or the apparatus created as a result of recommendations stemming from the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. The Vice President at the time, of course, was George Bush, who later became President, and who was formerly Director of the CIA. And during this archive show, what we've seen so far and what we're going to be seeing, we will be dealing with active complicity on the part of elements of our national security establishment with the very terrorism that we are told we have to combat. We are told that we have to have a more aggressive military posture abroad, increased security procedures at home, including reduced civil liberties and broader police powers, in order to combat the menace of terrorism. And in addition to justifying a more aggressive military posture abroad and increased security measures at home, the threat of terrorism has been utilized to, as I said, create an apparatus within the national security establishment which has been utilized and may very well be utilized to completely bypass the democratic process in this country. The counterterrorism, the fruits of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism run all the way from, as I said, the apparatus utilized by Oliver North to circumvent Congress and the Iran-Contra scandal, all the way on up through the martial law contingency plans drawn up by Oliver North and the National Security Council in conjunction with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And we will ultimately be looking at counterterrorism as the seed concept for the elimination or the potential elimination of democracy in this country. Certainly democracy has been badly compromised. Oliver North and company have apparently gotten off more or less scot-free after having thumbed their noses at the Constitution. And unfortunately, that thumbing of the nose at the Constitution is something which has grown directly, well, it's been going on for a while, but it has been formalized and sanctioned as a result, as I said, of things growing out of the Vice President's Task Force on Counterterrorism. We will be looking at counterterrorism, how it has evolved over the years, and specifically how it has been used to subvert American democracy and how it may be used to eliminate, may very well be used to eliminate American democracy in the not-too-distant future. We will range far from the subject of terrorism per se during the course of this discussion, but it should be remembered that terrorism has been the rationalization for the setting up of this apparatus. In Radio Free America program number 32, done in September of 1987, we discussed numerous connections between elements of our national security establishment and some of the very terrorists that we are told we are opposed to. In fact, as events have demonstrated, we have actively collaborated, or elements of our national security establishment have actively collaborated with these very terrorists. It should be noted in this context that our national security establishment is not a monolith. There are elements of the national security establishment that are very much opposed to terrorism, as they are opposed to drug dealing. The individual that I just interviewed, Harry Martin, for example, has very strong connections with a faction of the national security establishment that is opposed to those things. These people are not flaming liberals by any means. They are conservatives, but they believe in liberty and justice, and they do not believe in some of the things that have been going on. But there are other elements, in my opinion, more powerful elements of our national security establishment who sanction these very things. One of the points of collaboration that we looked at in Radio Free America 32 between elements of our intelligence system and international terrorism was the case of the Hindawi brothers. I'm going to review a very short section of Radio Free America program number 32. The other voice that you hear, in fact, the voice that you will be hearing on this segment almost exclusively, is the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who greatly assisted me in the execution of the on-air responsibilities in these archive shows. We're going to listen to a little bit of Radio Free America 32 that we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. Pay particular attention to the case of the Hindawi brothers, who have been involved in a number of terrorist incidents, or allegedly involved in terrorist incidents, ranging from an attempt to bomb an El Al airliner to the LaBelle discotheque. There are even implications that some of them may have been involved in the background of the Achille Lauro affair. Now, as you listen to this section of Radio Free America 32, bear in mind that as we looked at in numerous archive shows, including Radio Free America 35, the December surprise, the politics of terror, and the exoneration of the secret team, throughout the course of the Iran-Contra scandal, our national security establishment and the national security establishment of Israel have been deeply involved in both ends, I guess you could say, of the Iran-Contra scandal, the Middle Eastern end and the Latin American end as well. As we're going to come back after reprising a section of RFA 32, and we're going to hear some information from the book Prophets of War by Ari Ben-Menashe, a former Israeli intelligence agent who will also be discussing the Hindawi brothers. So we are going to jump back in time from January 24th of 1993 to September of 1987 and listen to a short section of Radio Free America program number 32.
Remember, Adnan Roussan, apparently working with Peter Ali on behalf of the United States government, shipping arms to Khomeini. At the same time, Adnan Roussan himself running with people like Abu Nidal, Adnan Khashoggi, and as we'll see, probably the people who were involved with the LaBelle discotheque bombing that injured several people and killed a couple. This is from La Repubblica for February 3rd, 1987. First part, Dateline, Geneva. Judge Paolo Martinelli has requested the release of two prisoners for insufficient evidence. They are Auni, A-W-N-I, Auni Hindawi, 25 years old, a student of political science in Geneva, and Adnan Roussan, age 40, officially the manager of an import-export company in Verona, but in reality an arms smuggler. Hindawi was arrested last June during the trial on the hijacking of the Achille Lauro. Roussan was arrested in his house a few days later. Other Jordanians were released earlier. During the course of the inquest, Luigi Carli, public prosecutor, came across many contradictions, such as a possible link between Hindawi and a terrorist network throughout Europe and possibly Italy. The other magistrate, Paolo Galizia, that followed up in the matter, however, found insufficient evidence to corroborate Carli's theory that Hindawi was plotting an ambush against the Italian government. The prisoners were released. However, they cannot leave the country. Hindawi must remain in Sassello, and Roussan must stay in Verona. Judge Martinelli said that even though they have been released, it does not mean there will not be more incriminating evidence against them. The inquest continues. Then, Dateline London, Auni Hindawi is a cousin of the two brothers, Nezar and Asi Hindawi. Auni was the contact in Italy for the organization, and Asi in Berlin. A year ago, Nezar tried to plant a bomb on an El Al plane by hiding it in his girlfriend's bag. He got 45 years. In Berlin, Hasi bombed the offices of an Arab-German company and got 14 years. He is still awaiting trial for the bombing of the LaBelle discotheque in Berlin, where two people died and 150 were injured, all of them Americans. Recently, the German magistrates interrogated Auni Hindawi about the discotheque bombing, suspecting he might have known something about it. It seems that Nezar, right after his arrest, wrote a letter to his cousin Auni asking for help to free him and his brother by setting up a mission in the Middle East to get hostages and request the exchange. Auni was arrested in order to put a stop to such plans. The inquest also discovered that Auni, along with two cousins, attended a training camp for terrorists in the Bekaa Valley. The instructors were followers of General El-Kuli, Assad's number two man. The discovery of the link between the Hindawi clan and the Syrian secret services, accused of having supplied the bombs for the London and Berlin incidents, have raised harsh reactions by the two governments. Auni Hindawi even went to Roussan's house in Verona to ask for arms. By Roussan's own admission, he sells arms with his government's approval. That's the Jordanian government. He even has dealings with Khashoggi to sell arms to Iran. As a matter of fact, when Rusin was arrested, he was entertaining a deputy of NATO, perhaps sent by Peter Alley, a big shot in NATO's secret services. So again, the connection not only between Adnan Rusin and the aforementioned, but also between Adnan Rusin and apparently the Hindawi clan involved with the El Al bombing attempt, the Label discotheque, I can't remember the name of the Arab-German firm they're referring to, but I remember the case. So a variety of rather interesting cases for these folks to crop up.
And again, that is a section from Radio Free America 32. Now, the names again, Adnan Rusin, a functionary of that section of the national security establishment of this country that was involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. He worked with, among others, Peter Alley, an American and a member of the intelligence community, and Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian arms dealer and middleman who was a prominent player in the Iran-Contra scandal. But the names to remember there are the Hindawis, associates of this terrorist milieu, which obviously has strong operational connections with elements of Western intelligence. Now, that program, again, was recorded in September of 1987. What we're going to do now is jump ahead to 1993, and we're going to read from a section of a book called The Prophets of War, or Prophets of War, I should say. That's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, subtitled Inside the Secret U.S.-Israeli Arms Network. This is authored by former Israeli intelligence operative Ari Ben Menashe. That's A-R-I, and Ben Menashe is capital B-E-N hyphen, capital M-E-N-A-S-H-E. Ben Menashe, like a great many intelligencers, has had some very accurate information to provide in the past. Some of his information has been spotty, but on the balance, most of what he has done has checked out. And in The Prophets of War, there is discussion by Ari Ben Menashe of a number of the most heinous terrorist acts of the 1980s, and Ben Menashe reveals that some of these acts were actively promoted by, and he refers to the Mossad connection to these terrorist actions. Bear in mind that in the 1980s, the United States, well, even before the 1980s, the United States and Israel were actively involved in collaborating vis-a-vis counterterrorism. We're going to begin by reviewing a short section of the book dealing with the Achille Lauro hijacking, which, according to Ari Ben Menashe, was organized as a, quote, black propaganda operation by the Mossad. We are then going to proceed to information allegations by Ari Ben Menashe that, in fact, the depredations of the Hindawi brothers, and in particular, the attempt to bomb an El Al airplane, that this also was a provocation, a so-called black propaganda operation staged by the Mossad utilizing Palestinian and Middle Eastern terrorist dupes, I would say, functionaries, in order to discredit the Palestinian cause. This particular book, by the way, The Prophets of War, was copyrighted 1993 and was published in hardcover by the Sheridan Square Press. And in The Prophets of War, Ben Menashe writes as follows. Speaking of this particular inside group in Israeli intelligence that was involved with the Iran-Contra scandal and the setting up of provocations, Ben Menashe writes as follows. The group's methods were rather unconventional. One could say heinous, but it had operated successfully for years. One example is the case of the, quote, Palestinian, unquote, attack on the cruise ship Achille Lauro in 1985. That was, in fact, an Israeli, quote, black, unquote, propaganda operation to show what a deadly, cutthroat bunch the Palestinians were. The operation worked like this. Eitan passed instructions to Radi, that is a Syrian functionary of this Israeli group. Eitan, that's Rafi Eitan, passed instructions to Radi that it was time for the Palestinians to make an attack and do something cruel, though no specifics were laid out. Radi passed orders on to Abul Abbas, who, to follow such orders, was receiving millions from Israeli intelligence officers posing as Sicilian dons. Abbas then gathered a team to attack the cruise ship. The team was told to make it bad, to show the world what lay in store for other unsuspecting citizens if Palestinian demands were not met. As the world knows, the group picked on an elderly Jewish American man in a wheelchair, killed him, and threw his body overboard. They made their point. But for Israel, it was the best kind of anti-Palestinian propaganda. And I would add that Oliver North also gained points for his alleged role in interdicting the hijackers after they finished with the Achille Lauro. Recall that one of his associates, Oliver North's associates in the Iran-Contra scandal, Manzer El-Kassar, a major focus of the research on these broadcasts, was involved not only with providing the arms to the Achille Lauro hijackers, but helping them escape afterward. this same black propaganda operation of Israeli intelligence, and as we saw in our coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal, they were working directly with U.S. intelligence. This same group, according to Ari Ben-Menashe at least, was also involved with the Hindali brothers, and that would tend to confirm the information presented in Radio Free America 32 in September of 1987. By the way, research credit on the article that you heard Niptuck reading belongs to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. Returning now to the allegations of Ari Ben-Menashe in the Prophets of War concerning the Hindali brothers and their connections to the Mossad, we find in 1986, Roddy was involved in another slush fund black operation. The well-docked, by the way, the slush fund is a slush fund set up as a result of the U.S. arms and Israeli arms transfers to Iran. Beginning again, in 1986, Roddy was involved in another slush fund black operation, the well-documented attempt to blow up an El Al plane, or at least what was publicly perceived to be an attempt. In fact, it was a cold, calculated plan conceived by Rafi Eitan to discredit the Syrians. And by the way, Rafi Eitan is R-A-F-I, capital E-I-T-A-N. Continuing, at a secret meeting in Paris, Eitan told Roddy that he wanted to implicate the Syrian embassy in London in terrorism and have all the Syrian diplomats thrown out of England. Roddy had a 35-year-old cousin, Nazar Hindawi, N-E-Z-A-R-H-I-N-D-A-W-I, living in London who had two things going for him. He was friendly with the Syrian Air Force intelligence attaché in London, and he had a problem with an Irish girlfriend who told him she was pregnant. Roddy went to his cousin and offered him $50,000. At the time, he told Hindawi that he wanted to do some work on behalf of Palestine that would also rid him of his troublesome girlfriend. Quote, "This money I'm offering you," unquote, Roddy told Hindawi, again quoting, "is from our Syrian brothers on behalf of the Palestinians. We want to blow up a Zionist plane. All you have to do is to make sure the girl gets onto an El Al plane with explosives in her bag," unquote. Roddy arranged for his cousin to meet the Syrian intelligence officer, and Hindawi later came away with the clear impression that what he was doing was for the Arab cause. In accordance with his briefing, Hindawi told his 32-year-old girlfriend, Anne Marie Murphy, a chambermaid at the Hilton Hotel on Park Lane, that he loved her and wanted to marry her. He was eager to introduce her, his future bride, to his old Palestinian parents who lived in an Arab village in Israel. He told her to go and visit them and receive their blessing. Then, when she arrived back in England, they would get married. Overjoyed, she agreed to go, not realizing that the address he gave her in Israel was bogus. As far as Hindawi knew, the woman was going to be sacrificed. All he had to do was tell her that he wanted her to take a bag of gifts to his parents. But because he didn't want to risk her being stopped for having too much carry-on luggage, he would arrange for a, quote, friend, unquote, who worked at the airport to pass her the bag when she entered the El Al departure lounge. She would pass through the regular Heathrow security checks and then be given the package containing the bomb. Hindawi had been told that a Palestinian cleaner would pass the deadly package to Anne Marie. In mid-April of 1986, he kissed her goodbye and watched her walk through passport control to what he expected would be her death, along with that of all the other 400-plus passengers on board the El Al jumbo jet. In the El Al departure lounge, an Israeli security man dressed in casual clothes, the, quote, Palestinian cleaner, unquote, passed the girl the parcel. She took it. But within seconds, she was asked to submit to a search. The security people, who were in on Rafi Eitan's plan, could not afford any accidents. When the bag was opened, plastic explosives were found in a false bottom. Anne Marie was rushed off to be interrogated by British security. Sobbing, she told the story of the rat of a boyfriend. Police arrested Hindawi at the London Visitors Hotel between Notting Hill and Earl's Court after his brother convinced him to give himself up. He spilled the beans and told them that a Syrian intelligence officer had asked him to carry out the task. But Roddy was not implicated. He was under MI5 protection. That's British intelligence interrupting. Resuming again, as a result, Margaret Thatcher closed down the Syrian embassy in London. Rafi Eitan had had his way. Hindawi was jailed for 45 years, and Anne Marie went home to Ireland where she gave birth to a daughter. These were the kinds of black operations our slush fund was financing. And again, that dovetails with the information presented in Radio Free America number 32 all the way back in September of 1987. Note that an Italian judge released one of the Hindawi brothers, and note also that according to Ari Ben-Menashe, the Israeli intelligence operatives who were advising the Hindawi brothers and using them, that they were posing as Sicilian dons, or not the Hindawi brothers, rather, but Abu Abbas. They were posing as Sicilian dons.